I'm Terry Thornton, and I'm Curator of Education, and it's my great pleasure to be a part of this Tuesday evening series. It happens every week. We're going through, I think it's April 22nd, but you need to either get online or pick up a schedule at the information desk for the spring. But it happens fall and spring, 10 lectures, fall, 10 lectures in the spring. It's free and open to the public, and we're really proud to offer it and really proud of the quality that the museum has been able to bring to you through this program. Let's see, next week, Joshua Mosley, who is the artist whose work was featured in the first Focus exhibition that just closed, I think, a week ago, he will be here to talk about his use of animation and sculpture to create installations that suggest a narrative while giving cause for investigation and consideration of the object at hand and its relationship to the stories or dramas that he meticulously crafts through various means of animation. In addition to that, he's going to speak, in addition to speaking on his own work, Joshua will introduce Frame by Frame, which is a series of films that he has curated for the Modern that show at 7 p.m. next Wednesday, so the day after his lecture, March the 12th. So I hope you'll be able to make it for both of those events. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Katrina Moorhead here to share her work and ideas, the work and ideas that have most recently won her the distinction of the second biennial Art House Texas Prize. Katrina was selected from five finalists who were selected from a pool of candidates that were nominated by art professionals throughout Texas, and therefore represents some of the most ambitious and exciting work being made by emerging artists in the state. While it is a statewide exhibition, it is recognized nationally, with jurors being distinguished curators, art directors, and art writers from Houston, Fort Worth, Austin, and New York. Of course, Katrina had received a great deal of recognition prior to the Texas Prize to, in fact, make her a likely candidate for such an award. She was born in Northern Ireland but now lives and works in Houston, where in 1996 she was accepted into the prestigious Core Artist in Residence program at the Glossell School of Art. Before coming to the States, Katrina received a BA in Art and Art History and an MFA in Sculpture from the Edinburgh College of Art and showed throughout the United Kingdom. But since coming to Houston more than a decade ago, Katrina's work has been seen in numerous solo and group exhibitions throughout this country and abroad, including in 2007, solo exhibitions, A Thing Called Early Blur at the Blafford Gallery at the University of Houston, and Low Slung Clouds, a gallery at Gallery Side 2 in Tokyo. And then in 2006, there was the solo exhibition, A Pretty Girl That This Man Does Not Love Her, at the Inman Gallery in Houston. And in 2005, the solo exhibition, An Island As It Might Be, at Art Pace, San Antonio, which was in conjunction with her international artist residency at Art Pace in San Antonio. Katrina was also a 2006 resident at the SIM Guest Studio Association of Icelandic Visual Artists at the Reykjavik Art Museum in Iceland, and was included in the 51st Venice Biennale, representing Northern Ireland Pavilion with On or About December 1981, which was the piece that she had in the show. It is a piece that I suspect she will include in tonight's presentation, which shows the depth and range of Katrina's work, much like the work that won her the Texas Prize, and that can now be seen in the exhibition Material Culture, which was curated by Francis Colpitt at TCU's New Gallery, Fort Worth Contemporary Art. On the Art House website, Katrina's work is aptly described as elegant drawings, objects, and installations that focus on the hidden, seemingly ordinary, or vulnerable aspects of experience, transforming them into extended moments of beauty and heightened awareness. This has certainly been my experience in seeing Katrina's work, and the reason that I wanted to share the work with you tonight through this presentation. So will you please join me in welcoming Katrina Moorhead.
can see myself here. That's weird. So thanks for coming out tonight. This is a really great courtroom that you have here. I know there's lots of other things to do, like voting. I guess everybody's done that already. Let me just see where I'm going with this. I'm just going to start like back when I was at college, at Edinburgh College of Art, but this is not what I did in college. That's what I did in my free time. But this is actually, if you go to school in Scotland, this makes sense. Nobody in your education ever like sort of references the notion of like selling art or anything like that. So when given like a commercial gallery space, you just do something else. And this piece is part of like is Gavin here? Mm-hmm. Okay, he'll be familiar with the Collective Gallery in Edinburgh, Scotland, and it has a floor-to-ceiling window on the front of it, and it is like somewhat of a commercial gallery. And this piece is, the show was called Karaoke Flux Fest. And this particular image is from the karaoke version of John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Bed In. I am smiling like a bit of a tourist there, but it was fun. It was 3 nights spent in the bed in the gallery, and 4 days of like doing like sort of Fluxus kind of referential pieces, like the Foundation of Plastic Poetry Day instead of Concrete Poetry, and so we actually painted signs and just did different things. And this was like, you know, it's kind of unusual. The rest of the street was like a shopping street, basically, and there was lots of kind of double takes coming down the street and looking in and like, what are those people doing in there? But also, it was pre-cell phone time, so if our friends wanted to speak to us, they had to come and sit on the end of the bed and like ask us things. So there was always like a good audience in the gallery, good attendance. That guy, he turns up later, but he's an artist as well. Straight away after finishing my master's degree in Scotland, I came to participate in the CORE program. I'd been to the United States before a few times, but now I was kind of staying for a bit longer and became really interested in... I mean, I was kind of freaked out, basically, by things like a man that was old enough to be my grandfather bagging my groceries, you know, when I could do it perfectly well myself. I really wasn't used to that, and I was always, like, getting people fired and stuff by doing it myself, and... But I just came across lots of weird materials or weird products that, you know, just weren't really, didn't make sense to me, but weren't available in the UK. And this is like a piece called The Reusable International Dateline from 1997. And it's made of reusable ice cubes for people that are too lazy to use normal ice cubes, I guess. And so they're little pockets, like plastic pockets of water that you freeze and use and then freeze again and store or whatever. And I just, this is in the Contemporary Arts Museum, Houston, and I stitched them all together to make basically a sculpture about a line. So it's like a hypothetical line that runs, like the biggest, well, one of the biggest lines that there is that's like understood. So it, you know, runs from pole to pole and delineates like one day from another, and so stitched those all together and followed the pattern of that line. And there's an obvious nod to the formal qualities of many Felix Gonzalez Torres works that I was a big fan of and still am. But when you were encountering this piece, it was like it was kind of really surprisingly solid for like a stitched item. It was like, it really refracted the light well. It was like a big sort of princess kind of thing. And some slight humor in there with the title, did. And this is before I stopped photographing artworks on carpet. This piece is called Saw a Woman Walking Her Plastic Bag. And it was kind of just, I don't know, it's kind of related to watching a lady that a plastic bag was following her and she couldn't get it to go away kind of thing. But it was also one of a couple of pieces based on swimming pool lane dividers and whatever they were supposed to mean. You know, which side of the lane divider are you supposed to be on? And then I sort of hooked them together and made the circle, and like, you're not sure if inside or outside is sort of the more important place to be. And I based the colours on one of those like candy bracelets that you get. Like, I bought lots of them and took an average of the colour arrangement. But I'm not really sure why anymore. But only because I was like using colour, which I kind of don't really do that often because it's a cheap trick. No, I didn't say that. And this is another one along the same lines, a different kind of float. And both of those pieces, the last one relied almost entirely on the elasticity of the materials that it was made of. You know, it had clear resin on the inside and then rubbers were stretched around it, but it all just, and then it was like on an elastic rope as well, so it all just held itself together and it had its own kind of like energy. And this is relying on gravity quite a bit, this piece, and it's just more resin pieces. And so that's just the bottom end of it, but it was strung floor to ceiling and kind of left random. But like the kind of currency of these, both of those objects is removed by their new arrangements, basically. I did quite a few pieces using the ubiquitous plastic bag, which lots of people have done at this point. But I made these collages that worked as collages in and unto themselves, and then like rolled them around fluorescent light tubes. And this piece is called Making the City Taller Than It Is and Horizontal. And this piece is called Futagoyama Sometimes. I don't know how much it's coming through, but I think it's kind of like this was just my awareness of kind of maybe more waste that I'd normally seen in this country than like where I'd come from. And so this is all still in the kind of same time period, 1997, 98. And I was observing how, well, I live in Houston and it's obviously like a car culture there. And I was interested in the idea of the little voice, like when you come to stop signs and there's like a telegraph pole, there's all these like staples and the remnants of notices that have gone up, you know, to kind of like, that's the only time you can get the attention of the public is they're finally stopped in their car for a second and you put the notices up there, and there's like this kind of like almost fetishistic kind of covering of rusty metal and remnants of. And so I actually made like a big billboard piece out of clear vinyl and just these random things all over it first, and then this is a secondary piece that referenced a particular mountain as portrayed in a Japanese woodcut. So it was like one artificial landscape to another kind of thing. And this was one of a series of pieces that about like wishing you were somewhere else. Working in the library at the Museum of Fine Arts, these things were under my desk where my feet should fit. Sort of packing materials used to house computer monitors or speakers. And some are actually from the trash. And I made a series of tragic fading Californian motel pools. So I made these tiny dollhouse tiles in like pre-faded colors. This one's not as faded as some of them, but like I definitely wanted them to already look past it. And then, but there's also a little bit of glitter, so there's kind of like tension, like bringing you to some place and then like back again. And I particularly liked ones with like holes in them or slits, like ones that couldn't actually hold water if they needed to. And they're called someone else's salt and sea. And each one is subtitled with the name of an existing Californian motel name. So the last one was Palisades, and this one is Sands. And it's kind of insane. I made the tiny tiles, baked them all, and spaced them using like a razor blade, and like cut them all, and then grouted some of them. I ended up not grouting all of them because I chose to. But someone else's salt and sea is kind of like anybody's good time, and it was just speaking of the manufactured resort and the kind of fakeness of all that, like the salt and sea. This is one of maybe three pieces of floral text, which is a kind of, I think it's kind of like a British phenomena, like to have something like an oyster festival advertised in floral writing, like actually bedded text probably in smaller towns. And so I think this was kind of slightly misunderstood in the context of the United States, but that's okay. Because people mentioned the Rose Parade and things, you know, but it was two things. This was like the reference to like advertisement and also to kind of funerary wreaths. And this was about trying to claim a moment and how you can't do that. So it's like kind of this tautology of like the language is like ideal total now is kind of like completely overdone. And as soon as I made this piece, it was dying. So it was kind of like referencing its own death and how you can't claim a moment. I always am working on drawings. They're usually kind of landscapes that don't and can't exist. So there's a lot of kind of, I use this color of paper quite a lot, this sort of surgical green, to kind of emphasize the artificiality of it. And a lot of repeated and mirrored imagery. Like that just wouldn't happen. You can have half of that and that's okay. And then it just makes it slightly more disturbing to have it mirrored so perfectly. But these are just something that keeps coming up. This is a billboard that I made. Lawndale Art Center in Houston was temporarily closed for refurbishment, and they put out an open call for proposals for billboard spaces. They had like six spaces, and I knew that I knew in advance that Clear Channel had the final say on, you know, what got through. So there was no swearing, no politics to do with race. There was like definitely certain things that couldn't be addressed because they just didn't want it to be, you know, they just wanted safe art. But I kind of recently watched the movie Brewster McLeod, where it's shot in Houston in the 70s, and when they're driving around, there's this complete absence of like sort of sky-based advertising. Like there's not all the signage that there is now, and that was kind of like very refreshing. And I thought, okay, well, my idea was to give the space of the billboard back to the sky. and kind of try to dissolve it and see if Clear Channel spotted that, you know, which, you know, either they didn't care about or... But anyway, so this one was selected. And so I went and selected Martha Stewart paint chips. Although that's not that important, but that's what they are. That specifically, mentioned or referred to the sky in their kind of romantic titling. So there were things like firmament and morning sky blue, cloudless day, and just made this grid, that fit. With the idea being that at any time of the day, part of this would be matching the sky and blending in, and that worked really well apart from at nighttime. But also, this billboard was tagged by a graffiti artist, but I took that as a real compliment because they obviously saw it as a blank canvas as well. So, this is a piece called An Island as It Might Be, which was in Art Pace, San Antonio, and it's an inverted kind of generic ballroom type ceiling, like an ornamental ceiling, just raised slightly off the floor and ended really abruptly and purposely in an ugly fashion. With all the elements that you would find in an ornamental ceiling, like chandeliers inverted and the some cornicing, just lots of cast plaster, and with all references to nature, and also a lot of unworked plaster, just dust. And it was after going to Venice for the Biennale, and seeing all these references to nature in all the architecture, but not really seeing a lot of actual nature itself, two parks or something. And so I kind of made the ceiling, but then it was breaking down and reforming itself back into a landscape. So the chandeliers were moving around and they bust through other cornices and things, and the kind of plaster dust had equal billing to the work plaster, and the synthetic light was fighting with, chose a studio that had a skylight, so it was fighting with the ambient natural light, and everything was changing all day in the space. And I even had a little wilderness wind that was just the ambient air conditioning in the room, but just turned up. We worked at length with the sound and using different pieces of equipment, but then it was much better just to sling the microphone over the top of the thing and just turn it up. And it was something that I noticed in the space when I walked in, because the space is your studio first and then the exhibition space not long after that. So it was just something that I thought I'd work with all the things that were already there, which is sheetrock. I mean, there were walls already, there were electric lights, so nothing was not sort of there already, and it just in a different form. So it was kind of it was the biggest space I'd had to work with, so I wanted to use it all. And the reason that I'd been in Venice was to present these pieces at the Venice Biennale. It was a pair of sort of full-size DeLorean gullwing doors made out of model-making materials. So these were basswood and plywood, and they're essentially the opposite of a prototype, which doesn't actually exist. So, and the reason that that I was thinking in those terms and presenting that was I wanted to encourage a reconsideration of the understood history of this failure, this motor car that was kind of like, what had just happened was the 25th anniversary of the rise and fall of the DeLorean motor company, which was like really fast. And I'd watched some documentaries in this country, and it was kind of completely bracketed as the flop. And then shortly after that, I'd gone home to Northern Ireland and seen documentaries, which was like a completely different story, because they had interviewed people who'd worked in the factories, or the factory there, which was, the factory is situated between a Catholic and a Protestant estate in the height of the Troubles. This is my only ever Northern Irish piece of work. And the Catholics would come in through one gate and the Protestants would come in through another just because of geography. But in this documentary, they interviewed lots of workers from the factory, and they all said that, you know, it was an amazing time. Like, even though, you know, they lost their jobs kind of as soon as they got them, they just remembered the excitement of having jobs and like making this so-called, you know, futuristic sports car. And when they were in that space, like there may have been a shooting or a bombing the night before, and apparently no one mentioned it in there, and so they spoke really positively of it. And I just wanted to make something to do with this, so you reconsider this history. And so the doors are the most essential part of the design, and the, you know, there's a story about cocaine, and that's, you know, supposedly the fall of the motor company, but it was actually, I think it was more actually weather than anything, because these cars were made for the Californian market, and they got to the east coast of the United States, but then there was like really bad winter and they didn't make it all the way across. So the title for this came to me before I understood like how well it fit, and it was on or about December 1981. And that is exactly like when it all started to go wrong. So when I was making these, it took me a while because, like, you know, I was as kind of unskilled as the workers in the factory. John DeLorean died, and I kind of felt really responsible for that in some way. This is a piece called The Issue of the 90s. And it came about because of my experience in Venice. I was there in advance of the openings at the Biennale, and there weren't that many people there yet, and then suddenly all these like black-clad art professionals turned up and were kind of sipping on their cappuccinos and whatnot, and I thought, wow, there's a lot of people that make a living off the thing that I do. You know, maybe I could do that too. So then I decided, like, well, how can I work with that? And then I thought, well, I'm going to make you can't really see it that well, but a pretty drawing of, like, someone else's text. And I chose Dave Hickey's, the first page of the first essay of The Invisible Dragon, and made an illuminated manuscript of the first page, just, like, and I kind of chose that because everyone was reading it when I first arrived here in the United States, and I was interested in that it was about beauty, and I was purposely trying to make a pretty drawing, and also because it was kind of like another thing that was kind of sort of past its sell-by date already, and I'm always kind of interested in that. A show at Inman Gallery was called A Pretty Girl That This Man Does Not Love Her, which was a kind of like a misunderstood or forgotten, not remembered correctly, title of a Sea and Cake song, to the point where, like, I actually, the meaning is almost the opposite of what it was. But I realized what the collection of objects that I was going to be showing was going to be, and then this kind of fit in that The Pretty Girl was a number of things. The Pretty Girl was architecture, and the Pretty Girl was nature, and like man was mankind, and then it was also like a little bit personal. I'm not saying I'm a pretty girl, I'm just saying it like more to do with the human than... So, but this was a piece called Donald Judd Box used as a shelf for an Adidas box. And it was actually made by that guy who was in bed with me earlier, originally in 1997. And I just always liked that piece. And it's the Donald Judd box is made of MDF painted to look like aluminum, and the so-called the plexiglass is actually just mat board covered in auto vinyl, and the Adidas box is made out of one piece of cardboard folded and painted with gouache. So, you know, and then I hand drew the labels just exactly as how they were. But I, of course, I had to ask permission first to do this, and I was just interested in that I'd never forgotten this piece, and I just wanted to make something that kind of had the same tenor as it, and then like I wasn't really sure how to do that until I finally, many many years later, just thought, oh, I just want to make the piece. So this was like kind of, you know, an acrimonious breakup with this boyfriend that, you know, lots of people have, I think, and or you can have. And so I was a little bit worried about asking him, you know, just like how weird was that. So it took me a long time to write the email for permission and, you know, many variations of it before I actually sent one. And then he was like, sure, no problem. It's so much richer now. Like, all this time has passed. And also, you'll make it better than I did. And I was like, yeah, I know that. And I did. And mine sold. But so along with it, I made this document, and it's, I don't know if you can read it, but it's like, you know, it's the barest certificate of transaction. This document certifies the following transaction between Robert Montgomery and Katrina Moorhead as authentic. Donald Judd box used as a shelf for an Adidas box originally made by Robert Montgomery in May 1995. Is to be remade by Katrina Moorhead in August 2006 in exchange for him breaking her heart sometime in January 1998. This transaction is considered complete by both parties and agreed upon as fair and binding as certified in this document. And then I FedExed it to him to sign, and then I signed it, and it was like kind of disappointingly easy. But then after that, of course, I had to be concerned about... I was still in the same arena that people were aware that we'd publicly broken up, like, this number of years before. And, like, they're like, oh, she's still hanging on to that. You know, it was like, I was worried about that, like, about pity. And, like, if anybody would find it funny. But, you know, it was actually really well received, which is awesome. And somebody bought it straight away. It was just like, yes. This piece behind there is two mirror balls hung low. Like, I selected a mirror ball that was enough to kind of illuminate or work the gallery, the size of the gallery, if it were a mirror ball, if it was still functional. And then brought another one in. And there's a really obvious reference to Felix Gonzalez Torres there as well. But dropped them low into the space, give them this pedestal, which is actually covered in like white grass carpet. So it's kind of like hovering between being like this artificial landscape with like two moons and this grass element, or, you know, like this kind of like has been party scene, and they're just touching one another, and they're the same height down, but I sprayed both of the mirror balls repeatedly with the most reflective silver paint that I could to kind of, so that they would lose their currency and their function. And it was called Numb Stars No Longer Shout. And that's kind of, and it's kind of about anybody's failed relationship, where you kind of, it's obviously over, but you're still like hanging out there together, can't quite leave one another. And that's more. So you can kind of see how they're like, then, you know, not very reflective, kind of just blurring, losing their facets. This was another piece from the, well, you know, just a reference to the DeLorean doors, the gullwing mirror, in also in basswood with a frozen reflection. Another piece in the same show, Astro Astrodome. When I first came to Houston, the Astrodome was, you could approach it. It was like Ayers Rock or something, like everybody loved it. It was no longer, well, it actually still was being used then, but I have been there that long. But it was just like a kind of dusty car park on the approach to it, and you could just go in and wander around. And I wanted to just create a kind of perfect drawing of it and went back to take photographs and stuff, and you couldn't get anywhere near it because it was in the shadow of a whole other stadium that was much, much bigger than it. And it had a car park around it, and it was all closed, and you couldn't. So it just made it like even more important for me to like make this like drawing. So I made it like they later added like wheelchair ramps and different things, but I made it in the most kind of pure form. So that's another pretty girl that this man does not love her, because they were talking about demolishing it at this point. Right when I was making that. This piece doesn't have a title, which is weird for me. This is part of a show that I made for Blaffer Gallery in Houston called A Thing Called Early Blur. I was given the opportunity to have a show at Blaffer, and I started working on it, but in the meantime I went to Iceland for a residency, and so everything kind of changed, and then I did a completely different show. This is a Reka bottle, or like a vodka that just came out at the time that I was going there. And I just saw this as, having tasted it, I saw it as like a product that was riding on the back of like the music industry of like that was coming out of, or associated with Iceland. And because I kind of felt like if Iceland was meant to have a vodka, it would have one already. It wouldn't just develop one in 2006. So I think it was riding on the back of the new awareness of that country. So I got the bottle and I drilled many, many holes into it, which isn't very easy. So they had to get a Scottish brewer or like to come to Iceland to teach them how to make the vodka, just, and then they run their water through the lava rock, and that's why it's Icelandic. So it just seemed like really kind of absurd. So this is a sculpture in my opinion, but it's a drawing in a frame of a mountainside which is snow-covered, and kind of relates to the title of the show, A Thing Called Early Blur. In all the guidebooks to Iceland, I was reading about the frequency of, like, of hallucination. Like, whenever you're walking towards a large object, it becomes smaller, and vice versa, because of the really particular climate. And whether I experienced that or not as something else, but I was just really interested in how that fact kept turning up. So I made this drawing that you could kind of like fall into. Um, It's called 288 Islands. This is called Moonscape Landset, and it's like one set of trees and then another identical set, just slightly smaller, but they share the same kind of tree line, the top line, and there's a variety of moons. This piece is called Horizontal Waterfall, or How You Lost Your Loveliness. It's kind of like another appropriated piece. I saw a waterfall made of glimmer dots, which is this like sequin signage kind of thing, in a building in Reykjavik, like on the street. And I was thinking that's really weird because like Icelandic people are so proud of their very peculiar style of, very particular style of nature. And I just, you know, I couldn't really understand why they were kind of cheapening it in this way. It was like done by an architect from Denmark, but I wanted to just take it one step further and turn it on its side to kind of reduce its currency even more. So it actually comes round the corner, and you know, you can only like at some points sort of experience it as like a waterfall. You can only kind of see it in some. An image of a drawing of some lace, a vintage lace curtain that referenced nature in its design. And this is just to show you how I went in December, and I thought I'd been totally shafted because I wanted some other month, and I thought it's just going to be dark all the time. But actually, like, it was the same weather as it is, or the same sort of daylight availability as it is in Scotland or Northern Ireland, like pretty similar. But in December, you also get these amazing, like, pink and purple palette in the sky. And this was a piece called, in the same exhibition, Moon, Huge and Low and Does Not Leave. And it was kind of meant to be like a kind of I'm a kind of slight metaphor for Iceland, this kind of really precarious object. Once again, I just use materials that would be in the space already, like sheetrock. There's already walls in there and lights. Okay, I use colored ones, but like just keeping it really kind of to the bare essentials. And half of it has got all these colored lights that reference like those weird skies, but also the nightlife, and then the other half is like all daylight simulation bulbs, and some of them are flashing, so it's kind of animated. But I used the design from that lace curtain and just like drilled repeatedly into the sheetrock to create these kind of, you can kind of read the like foliage and stuff in there, but also it's scalloped in the bottom, so the whole thing kind of with the light appeared to be kind of floating and precarious, and that's kind of what I felt like. You know, Iceland was weird because this really confident body of people like in this really kind of unlikely place that know that they have a lot to offer in terms of like creativity and nature, and you know, it's just kind of like. And this is a piece that is in the show that Francis Culpe put together for the new TCU space. It's called Drama Landed, a red, green, blue peony. I was still in Iceland for New Year's Eve, and I'd had the experience of seeing the Aurora Borealis and being the only person that was like saying, holy crap, you know, because everybody else was like very used to it. But I found myself saying that out loud in the street and then feeling weird about it a little bit. But on New Year's Eve, they have the most fireworks going off in like, you know, I think anywhere in the world, that's what they say. So it just seemed really weird to have such beautiful phenomena like naturally occurring and then to just see the absolute madness of what was going on New Year's Eve, just like kids setting off stuff everywhere, like rockets going between your legs and everything in the sky just animated for hours. And then like all this detritus, this kind of like, and this particular bench, I kind of recreated this from a photograph of something that I just thought looked really kind of landscapey unto itself. And so I made this all out of archival materials, the glue and the cardboard and the like the tubes, everything just made out of paper. So, you know, this potentially could be around for a long time. And just painted by, like, watery watercolour, all the markings on the boxes. And so that was, like, my sort of the story of the has-been fireworks. And then there were the other fireworks that whenever I needed a manual to make the other stuff because I wanted everything to be like accurate in terms of sizes and everything. So like, you know, I carefully researched that and then I got into reading this manual and came across Japanese aerial shells, which you would never see. Like the other things you would definitely, you can buy. But these are like more like display fireworks. And this particular bunch, I just kind of, like, reading the manual, I was just really interested in how specific everything was, like, certain sizes of balls exploded to a certain size of display, and, you know, it was such a language unto itself, and I was just interested in what if you apply something that you can't control, to, you know, and kind of merge it, like meld it into this one object. So these, each one of these pieces actually represents like a sort of a romantic courtship, having interviewed like three sets of couples, including myself, and then describing their courtship in firework form. You know, like creating this language, like keeping it really simple, but like that's basically what it was, and then these really different forms came out, and all of these people are still together. But these are also made out of just the same techniques, going by the manual, but using archival papers and glues, and you know. So these have potential, where the other one were already kind of like spent, and they're just like kind of ready to burst kind of thing. But it's, this is where I TP'd a major institution in Houston, but maybe that shouldn't be on there. But I did. That was one of my best ephemeral pieces. Anyway, I think that's pretty much. What I have to say. If anybody sees any current, like a thread that runs through all of this work, let me know, because I'm writing my artist statement right now and it'd be really handy. No, I think like a lot of, you know, like I sort of see each of the pieces as kind of the same as like one another. Like they're all the same piece to me. They're just, they're really different forms. But like it's kind of tone or atmosphere that I'm interested in as much as physical object. But I definitely have to get to that by making the object first. So, but it's I think it's definitely like tone or tenor is my priority. You can't sell that. I see, like, I'm really interested in titling. Like, there's very few things that are not titled with something that's kind of, you know, slightly elaborate. I just see it as, like, this other opportunity to sort of lead the viewer in a certain direction. Because I pare everything down so much, or I feel like I do, like especially like the, you know, rare use of color, then I just think that there's another way of, you know, it's just like a privilege to be able to title something. But also because I used to write poetry, and then I won this award when I was 16, and the local paper published my poem, and I was really pissed off. And thought, that's the end of that career. No way, you can't do that. But so I think that it's really like a nice opportunity to work with language as well. And it's just this, it's almost equal to the piece sometimes. And I just answered a question that might have been asked, but maybe not. For the shows?
The titles of the shows and the title of the pieces, it seems like the language, like you were saying, has a sense about it that I get from the pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like harder to title a whole show whenever you've already titled these elaborate things, like within that already, but if it doesn't come naturally, then things get left untitled, but probably not a show. That probably doesn't happen to a show. And sometimes the title comes before the piece, and sometimes it doesn't come, and sometimes I just write a song instead.
What happens to the song?
No, I'm kidding.
You want to do questions?
Only easy questions.
How have you survived Houston?
How have you survived Fort Worth? Same way. You go to Iceland every now and again, or Ireland. It's all right. I mean, I think I tried to escape a few times, but there's like I've just always been busy, and it's all right most of the time, I think. Have you been? They usually ask me first to put the art in a show. That was the problem.
I thought maybe you were referring to the personal exposure involved.
No, that's actually become all right. But it was just a surprise to me, and it was like a really, you know, just poor local paper. But I was like, I don't know, you're allowed to do that, but. That's probably enough.
Thank you.